thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I'm going to...
Here's John Williams.
Sing. That's my big thought today. It's advice I want you to, if it ever possible, go to Eric and Mary's Songs of Good Cheer. Songs of Good Cheer is a Christmas sing-along that the columnist Eric Zorn and the columnist Mary Schmick do from the Chicago Tribune. They have, over the last 19 years, given how much money? Over $600,000 in ticket sales goes to needy kids and charities around Chicagoland. They raise that money every year with their Songs of Good Cheer. And the first show for Eric Zorn and Mary Schmick's Songs of Good Cheer, a Christmas sing-along with the folks from the Old Town School of Folk Music, was last night. And Brenda and I were there. And my sister Jean and her friend Alfreda were there, too. Jean just happened to be in town for a conference, and her colleague was in town as well. So there we were doing some family holiday stuff. And it sounds so cliche, but family holiday stuff is sometimes harder to come by. We're all so caught up with news and stuff these days. Some of us have had trouble dragging ourselves into the holiday spirit. And then you put on a red sweater and you sit in an audience of a couple of hundred people at the Old Town School. And Eric and Mary go up there with those super-duper talented musicians and singers. And they give you a songbook and you sing some songs and you think about those songs. And Eric and Mary's patter is minimal but perfect and funny. It's just a delightful evening. And now I've got the spirit that I didn't previously have. Steve Bertrand did not go to last night's show and is still wallowing in January through November.
Christmas is coming.
Mary Schmick's Christmas carol called Gonna Sing is a song we sing every year at the event. And they opened with it with really no fanfare last night. It is one of the loveliest songs you'll ever hear. It's one of the best Christmas songs you'll ever hear. And yet you don't know this song unless you go to that show. And the first verse of the song is this. Oh, it's Christmas time again, and we're all a little older. Life rushes like the wind, and the year's already gone. And some people that I love said goodbye and crossed on over. But I'll hold them in my heart as I sing this song. I'm gonna sing, and then the chorus is, till I can't sing no more. Can't worry when you're singing. Maybe that's what singing's for. I'm gonna sing. And the world won't seem so weary singing songs of cheer and hope and joy and love. Gonna sing. And we round the bases again with another verse of that. It's the loveliest dang thing you've ever heard. And people wipe tears away as we sing it. It's the perfect song. Mary, your talents know no bounds, and thanks to all the folks that were there last night. I was just in the audience having fun, but I want you to know that should be on your Christmas list of things to do. Speaking of property taxes, Jason Grotto's in our studio, and he writes for ProPublica. Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm good, John. How's it going?
Thanks for coming back into our studios.
Thanks for having me.
You famously made life miserable for Cook County Assessor Joseph Berrios. When this summer, you and the folks at ProPublica, actually it was with the Chicago Tribune at the time.
Yeah, I was with the Tribune then.
Wrote a piece, a long, lengthy piece, actually a series of pieces, about property taxes in Cook County and how unfairly they're assessed, how the rich almost certainly don't pay their fair share and the poor pay more than they should on their residences. Today, ProPublica, where you now work, and the Tribune partnered with you on this, have posted a piece that at extraordinary length says essentially the same thing about business properties in Cook County. What's going on here?
Well, what we did is we examined the assessment system. So the assessment system is arranged in a way where the assessor does what's called the first pass value. It's supposed to be sort of a good faith estimate of what property values are worth at the time. And then if the property owners have an issue with it, they can appeal to the assessor. That's second pass. And then the adjustments could or cannot be made. And then if their taxpayer is still not happy, they can go to the Board of Review and do another appeal. And then they can go to circuit court after that, but then it's in the courts. But what we did is we looked for commercial and industrial properties at this first pass value, this sort of, the statutes say that every 3 years the assessor in person or by deputy shall actually view and determine as near as practical practicable, the value of each property listed for taxation. As
and then you get
1st.
A thing in the mail that says, by the way, here's what your valuation is.
Then you get an assessment notice, and then you can say, no, this isn't right, and you can appeal. And so we looked at those first pass values, and what we found was that for thousands of properties across the county over multiple reassessment periods, and granted, you know, remember, these are within every 3 years these valuations are done, we found that values weren't changing. That there were values done under the previous assessor, James Houlihan, that were identical to the ones in 2009, that were identical to the ones in 2012, and for thousands of others, there were ones that were identical even in 2015. And so, you know, we took this information to experts, and what they said is that they're not actually valuing the properties, that they're putting a value out there, and then waiting for the appeal process to actually come up with the number that they intend to use.
And it's not like, and they almost sound random numbers. That is, the fact that they're the same tells you that, in fact, there's been no activity. At least that was my assessment, because the value might be $437,282. Mm-hmm. And then 3 years later, it
same
is
exact
to the dollar the same amount.
That's right. And it's all supposed to be, the real estate market, certainly the commercial real estate market, but the real estate market in general, it's a dynamic market, especially in a big city like Chicago.
But is the assessor's office supposed to look at every single property in Cook County? What, there's a million of them, right?
There's 1.8 million parcels. There's about 50,000. So we looked only at the city of Chicago for this story. And there are, by the assessor's count, 50,000 commercial and industrial parcels.
50,000. Mm-hmm. So every 3 years, they should examine every single one of those and assess its value? Mm-hmm.
And the way it's done is on spreadsheets. So it's not like they do each one individually. Our understanding from what we can glean from interviews and other documents and things that we've been able to dig out, because the assessor won't tell us exactly how they do it. What they do is they take within a neighborhood or, you know, an area, they take a certain type of property and they create spreadsheets of all those properties. And then there are market variables that are supposed to go in there. Cost per square foot for rent, for expenses, vacancy rates, or something called the capitalization rate. That's kind of in the weeds. And that's always, those things are constantly fluctuating.
So they plug this math in and then it should generate a number.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't require them, you're saying, for them to knock on every door or eyeball every property.
Mm-hmm.
They can do it with a computer or a program, I guess.
I mean, especially in today's world. I mean, you know, I had one person that I spoke with who was defending the system, saying, well, this is the way it's been done for 50 years. Well, you know, 50 years ago, there weren't personal computers that could, you know, hold massive databases.
Well, it would seem to me like we all know what's happened to real estate over any given 3 year period. I mean, in 06 to 09, everything went into the crapper, and and then we've sort of worked our way back up. But isn't there some equivalent of the gross domestic product of Cook County that you could say, or you know what the average selling price is? Mm-hmm. Say the average selling price went up 1% in Cook County this year, then everybody's property should automatically be assessed 1% more.
Yeah, that's called factoring, and some people have done that. I
don't love that, maybe, because maybe that doesn't, but then I would appeal if I said, but in my cluster of businesses or homes, it didn't go up 1%.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't do that, evidently.
I mean, for these thousands of properties that we found that where the values didn't change, we don't believe they did that. So when I was with the Tribune, we ended up suing the assessor to try to get some of this information. We're still in court because they appealed the ruling. We won in circuit court. The judge ordered them to turn over the records, and they declined to do that.
But are you also saying, okay, so while that sounds like maybe an inefficient or inexcusable way to do the job, what you did find also, am I not right, is that the more expensive properties tended to be assessed at a value lower than they should be. And if you ran a business on the west side, you might actually be assessed at a value higher than its value, than its sale price.
That's right. So the story, it's sort of, I call it a three-legged stool. The first leg, we looked at whether these first pass values changed or not. The second leg, we did an analysis called the sales ratio study, where we look at the assessor's value and we look at properties that sold, and we compare those two numbers and come up with this. It's basic division. We come up with numbers, and then there's some statistics that you run to see how those numbers are distributed, you know, like in a graph or something. And yes, that's exactly what we found, which is the same thing we found with residential properties, which is higher-end, higher-priced properties are assessed much lower than lower price properties.
Are they assessed or do they just pay less because they got expensive attorneys to petition the county to lower their taxes?
Well, that's the third leg of the stool. So then we did a big analysis on the appeals and the appeal process and who gets reductions and how much are the reductions and how many appeals are out there. And yes, so if you're we highlighted a daycare down in the Auburn Gresham neighborhood called the Sweet Pea Academy. They did not peel their assessment. Their assessment was on the year that they bought the property was much higher than
it was like $17,000, wasn't it?
That was the bill. The bill was $14,000, but they bought the place for about $200,000, and it was the assessor came up with a value of I think it was $327,000. I don't quote me on that, but around there.
It was over three. Yeah, I saw
that. Yeah, and so because they didn't appeal, they ended up paying more in taxes than they should have.
You said maybe $5,000 more than they should have.
$5,500 more, I think.
What a shame for this mom and pop operation. They're running a daycare, whatever. It really doesn't matter what the business is, but $5,000, I would imagine, matters a lot to them. Okay, but what the county tells you your property is worth and what you paid for it could be different things. It's possible that the county may be more right than you are. That is, maybe the property is in fact worth more now, or maybe you got a sweetheart deal. This reminds me of some of the conversations you had with the residential stuff.
Sure.
I mean, whose number is right? Answer that.
Well, all the experts say the right price is the price that was paid in the open market. Now, there are some extenuating circumstances. So, for example, if there's a relationship between the two parties, that could affect things. If it's a religious organization, they might get a break in some way. And so when we did our study, what we did is, first of all, there are documents from the state that describe the type of sale that it was. It was what they call an arm's length transaction. So we screened out to make sure that we got arm's length transactions. And then for commercial industrial, it's a little bit more complicated because you have LLCs and whatnot. And so we spent, months really going through, culling through the list and comparing the seller and the buyer to make sure that they weren't related in any way.
Do you have a degree in mathematics?
No.
I thought I saw somewhere that you had some sort of...
I did a fellowship where I studied municipal finance.
Where'd you do that fellowship?
Harvard University.
That's what I found. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's 1:21. Let's pause for just a second and come back.
Great.
I got a couple more questions about this. And by the way, maybe you have a business in Cook County. I'm kind of curious what you make of this report and what your business property taxes are. And did you get a fair shake? Have you appealed and how did that go? My number is 312-981-7200. This is WGN. A couple of phone calls for Jason Grotto from ProPublica. What is ProPublica for people that don't know what that is?
ProPublica Illinois is an office that just opened up in July. Our mothership is in New York. It's a nonprofit investigative reporting group that collaborates with other journalists and gives our content away for free.
How do I get it then? I mean,
if you go online, if you go to ProPublica.org/Illinois, you'll see the ProPublica Illinois website where all of our content and stories will be.
And that's for free?
It's all free.
Are they going to eventually charge me if I subscribe to or click through?
Well, we run on donations. So
how's business going on that department, by the way?
We're doing okay.
I've heard nothing but good things about what ProPublica does. So many of us have read so many of their stories. Mm-hmm. Lord knows they've got some of the best reporters in town.
Well, ProPublica Illinois is the first regional office for ProPublica. And so it's a really exciting opportunity. And, we've got some great colleagues I'm working with.
Mike, you're on WGN Radio. What can we do for you? Hi.
Hi. I had a question. Born and raised in Illinois, we have two pieces of property, a residence and a business. And what makes me angry is, what really makes me angry is I remember when our Cook County assessor was elected, and when he came in, I guess he fired all the people that worked for Cook County, all the people that worked for that office, and hired all his relatives. And, it just goes back to all the patronage and corruption in Cook County. And I think that has a lot to do with, who gets favorable treatment on real estate income tax reductions. For example, Pritzker, he had that piece of property, that $1 million property that he disconnected the toilet. And that was supposed to be a piece of property that was
It was uninhabitable after that.
And you got that huge reduction. So it's just, I think, because it's, I think property tax is almost like a zero-sum game. There's only so many properties, and if somebody has to pay more, I mean, if somebody gets a discount, then the other people have to pay more.
You're touching on a lot here, Mike. Hold on a second. I'm really glad you called. Let me put you on hold because we're running short of time, and he's right about the zero-sum game part, right? That it's a fixed amount, say, on the business side that you wrote about today. If somebody gets a reduction, then everybody else has to make up the difference. True?
That's correct. There's this, what they call the levy. It's what government needs to run all of the different agencies, and that number stays the same. And so it's a matter of how do you distribute that.
When Alderman Burke gets a discount for Trump Tower, then everybody else has to make up the difference.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that Trump Tower does not deserve a discount.
No, it doesn't.
Or that the work of those attorneys is bad. But Burke has an ethical issue that everybody's pretending doesn't exist. And then what about Berrios's family members? You touched briefly on that in your story. Talk about that.
Well, there was a, going back to the 70s, there's something called the Shachtman Decree, which touched on the city and a lot of county agencies, and it dealt with political patronage and patronage hiring and whatnot. And there have been, for the last few years, a monitor inside the assessor's office monitoring the hiring and all of this. And it is true that some of his family members work there, and it is true that some people were laid off, and many of those people were among the people with the most knowledge in the room. I mean, some of the other things that the caller said, I have no proof of that whatsoever. I would just say that in terms of, you know, quid pro quo or whatever, I think that the bigger issue is the lack of transparency. I mean, we just don't know what's going on inside the office.
Your article does say, though, that they say that they are more efficient now rather than carrying $5 or $6 million, a month or a year or whatever.
That's their number. I have never been able to verify
but
that.
But they're processing these things more quickly, and that is saving the county money, and that has the ring of truth to me. Give them that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. There's definitely some. All the experts say, you know, getting the bills done out on time. If the bills don't go out on time, then people don't pay on time, then local government agencies have to borrow money to make up the difference. You know, the issue here is that should that be done at the expense of fairness and accuracy? Because then it's, some groups are paying more for those interest costs than others.
Yeah. For Christmas, I want them to be both fair and accurate and timely. I want both. I want both of those things, and I don't know that that's unreasonable to ask for. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing from Berrios' office before the end of the day today, and I know you will be too. Last time he did this, they called a major press conference, so we'll continue to follow the story. Go to ProPublicaIllinois.com.
Or the Chicago Tribune.
And find the story from Jason Grotto and company about the property tax business in Chicago, in Cook County.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So many of the Facebook posts are touching. John, I love and miss my son Joshua and his wife Suzanne. They live in Ohio, but I work in retail and only get Christmas Day off. I hate for them to travel so far to see me, so I just stay home and I visit them when we can. John, I unfortunately cannot be with my parents on Christmas. Many years in a row now, is there about a 3-hour drive away? My husband and I both work in the grocery business, and for obvious reasons, we are mandatory for work. We do, however, have 2 Christmases with his family a week apart. God knows I love his family, but, well, at least there's alcohol a-flowing. This one says, John, I miss my son Andrew, who was also born October 19th. Hey, that's my birthday! And also loves Teddy Roosevelt. I love Teddy Roosevelt. He is currently deployed as he is a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. He'll be coming back in February. This will be the first Christmas without him. And every time he comes home, the first thing he asks for is a deep dish pizza. Boy, it's going to be hard to say no to that one, huh? But with the birthday and lieutenant and all. John, I would love to spend a Christmas with my 16-year-old granddaughter, Lacey, but she lives in Louisville, Kentucky. I have never spent a holiday with her. I supervise a group of secretaries, and I choose to work so they can have time to travel with their families. I love these gals, and I'm happy I can do this for them. John, our son lives with his family in Georgia. We'd love to be with them for the holidays, but can't afford the trip this year. They love Georgia, and we love Lou's. Okay, so we'll randomly pick here a couple of those and a couple of the texters, too. Let's talk to Sandy. Hey, Sandy, it's John. You're on. You know what's interesting to me, too, Sandy, is that I think that sometimes we take it for granted that everybody gets off at Christmas and people can be together, but that's not true. Sandy, you're on. What do you want to say? Hi.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. What's up?
So my son and daughter-in-law, they just had our first grandchild in February, and they have decided to relocate to where my daughter-in-law's family is from in Syracuse, New York.
Oh.
And my daughter-in-law and granddaughter left in September to go out there so that she could find a job, and my son stayed behind here to sell their home. And he works in the restaurant business and will not be able to get off for Christmas. She has not been able to find a job. He has not been able to sell their home. It's going on 3 months that they've been separated, and they're not going to be able to be together for his daughter's first Christmas.
Wow.
And we miss them extremely. So I just thought it would be nice to send, you know, part of Chicago back out to them as a sign that, you know, we miss them.
Ding, ding, ding. Okay, you win. All right, so here's Sandy, I'm going to give you the gift card. I want you to spend $100 any way you want and send them a whole bunch of stuff from Chicago, okay?
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you so much, Jen.
Talk to Elif off the air. And Jenny, on my Facebook page, we're going to include you. And let's see, Jill, Jenny and Jill, we're going to include you. And among our texters, let's go with John. I'm missing my younger brother, who, since he lost his wife 15 months ago from a 15-year battle with cancer, no longer comes to the Chicago area. He lives in South Carolina. He loves pizza from Lou's, which is the king. No offense, John. We love your show. And he'd love to have a Lou's gift pack. We'll give those four away this time. Now, next week we'll do it, and we'll ask for cheerier things to talk about. But that's the way it works. And this has just been interesting to see how hard maybe the holidays are for some people when they can't all be together. Okay, it's 1:47. Two things that we'll talk about in the next hour, by the way. One is we'll visit with the Israeli consulate here in Chicago. A representative is coming over to talk about their views on what the president said and did yesterday about Jerusalem. We will also visit with a friend of mine who does a talk show in Minneapolis, because that state and city and the U.S. Senate are reeling on the news that Al Franken is, in fact, going to step down.
Tim Pawlenty for senator.
Is that what they're saying?
Well, that's some of the pressure up there now. Pawlenty, the former senator, would be you were going to vote for him for president, right?
Yeah, I did like him, and I do like him. He's a good guy, and he's a moderate, but he's also a Republican. So I don't know that.
Well, he's won up there statewide before, right? They've had Republican senators.
Oh, this is not about putting a qualified person in the seat, Steve. I mean, who are you kidding me?
No. So the governor will name someone,
and it'll be a Democrat.
Oh, sure, it'll be a Democrat, and but there will now be a special election in 18.
Yeah, sure.
So
boy, that's right around the corner.
Less than a year from now.
I don't know if you know that, but 2018 is next year.
It's almost to next week.
And so, yeah, no kidding. So T-Paw's going to run?
Well, he's just one of the names people are wishful thinking for the Republicans, I think.
Yeah.
He hasn't weighed in yet.
Yeah. Yeah, we asked Tammy Duckworth, our own senator here, to come on the show today, and I'm not sure why she said no. She's busy, but today would be a good day to step up and say why you think that Al Franken should step down. She did, as did Dick Durbin. Al Franken's cohort, the other U.S. senator from Minnesota, is a woman who herself has, she has not said whether or not, Amy Klobuchar is her name. And I do not believe Senator Klobuchar has said whether or not he should step down. They're both the same party. They're both highly regarded up there. And Amy's been quiet about this. Tammy has not. Anyway, we'll talk more about that in the next hour.
You want another one?
Yeah.
Harold Ford, the former congressman from the South, Tennessee, I think.
Yeah.
Is been fired by Morgan Stanley today
after
an allegation. He also is a commentator at MSNBC and teaches, I think, public policy at the University of Michigan. He issued a statement saying that the charge against him is absolutely untrue, but Morgan Stanley today fired him from his job.
When you said, do you want another one? That's not what I meant. I don't want any more of those, Steve.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
That's what we do.
Here's John Williams.
Each and every day. Thank you, Steve. It's 206. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio.
Lord have mercy.
On Michigan Avenue all the way until 3 o'clock. By the way, next week we'll give away more of those Chicago gift packs from Malnati's, the Tastes of Chicago. Next Thursday, I'll ask you a question. You give me some answers. We'll give away some more of those $100 gift cards or packs so you can send Lou Malnati's and Tastes of Chicago to loved ones.
So can I talk Olympics for a second here?
Yeah, real quick, go.
All right, so yesterday Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, said that it wasn't clear that the U.S. would participate in the South Korean Olympics, apparently because of security. And Sarah Sanders was asked about that during the briefing this afternoon.
No official decision has been made on that.
Which seems to indicate that there's a possibility the U.S. wouldn't send its athletes a short time. In fact, just minutes after the briefing was over, she then sent out a tweet that said the U.S. looks forward to participating in the Olympics, the Winter Olympics.
Okay, which is still to me vague. I mean, looks forward to. I look forward to a lot of things that don't happen.
Yeah, but I think they're trying to step it back now that it looks like, you know, I don't know if people were talking or were out ahead of their skis.
Yeah.
Get it? Winter Olympics?
Oh, I got it. I'll laugh later. I'm kind of busy right now.
but pulling it back now a bit.
Thank you, Steve. It's 208. We'll keep you posted on that story, too. Also, Senator Franken's comments are visited on this show after the 2:30 edition of WGN Radio News. So yesterday, Donald Trump said that the U.S. will officially move its embassy to Jerusalem. It has not happened yet. In fact, it might not happen at all, but what the president said and did yesterday was significant, and if the United States follows through on it, we would be the first nation then to also have its official business done there. In our studio is Moran Berman. He is the consul for public diplomacy at the Consulate General of Israel to the Midwest. So you office here in Chicago, correct?
Yes, we are here in Chicago, and we cover 9 states throughout the Midwest.
Welcome to the studio. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very good, very good. Not the best weather, but I'm good.
Oh, listen, how long have you been in Chicago?
A little over a year.
I got news for you. Yeah. This is good weather.
This is good. Okay.
I don't know, what's the average temperature in Israel right now?
Well, the winter in Israel will be 40, 50, yeah. So never snows, so...
It'll be 40 or 50 here, but that's below zero.
Yeah.
So you've spent time in Philadelphia, I know, Moran, but you'll definitely need your winter coat.
Oh, yeah.
You're happy about this announcement by the president, I presume.
Yeah, yeah, I am happy about it, and Israel's happy about it. We think it's a historic day for the state of Israel, and we're grateful for the president for this announcement.
Did you see it coming?
You know, there were rumors, they were speaking about it. We knew there is a big statement from the president at the same day. I actually watched it live with a few of my colleagues. I was in New York yesterday in a conference with the Israeli diplomats. So we all watched it live, and it also gave this a little bit of a nice atmosphere, you know, for this conference to see it live. But we didn't have any inside information of what's going to happen.
Did you burst into applause? Was there a lot of backslapping? What was the reaction among the top diplomats?
You know, when they announced that the state of Israel in 1948, people were dancing in the street. So this is not happen. This is not what happened. And we're also diplomats, you know, we are trying to remain calm. But, you know, everybody were happy. We knew it means a lot of work. We unfortunately knew that it also might cause tension, uprising, maybe violence in Israel, in the West Bank, in other areas. So we knew we are going to have a lot of work.
What did the people of Israel say?
So most of the people of Israel support this. I have to say, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and not only since the beginning of the state of Israel, but long before that, it was the capital of the Jewish people. You know, usually a country is a state or a country is founded, and then it chooses its capital. So Washington, D.C., became the capital in 1790, I think. Before that, it was Philadelphia, where you mentioned I used to live. But Jerusalem was the capital and the heart and the soul of the Jewish people for 3,000 years. So when the State of Israel was founded in 1948, it was natural that there wasn't even a question where the capital will be. So the people of Israel are generally support and thankful for President Trump for that. Of course, Israel is a democracy, and we have many different opinions. So not all of the people of Israel support that. Of course, we also are worried about the violence that it may cause.
Well, that's why I would care. I mean, you know, symbolism notwithstanding, or the importance that you just said it means to the Jewish people, but listen, there's plenty of Americans who now don't want to travel that part of the world, let alone live in that part of the world, because they fear what's now going to happen.
Yeah, and I can understand that, but we have to remember, first of all, violence is not an answer to anything, and it's never a solution. And also, you know, as Israelis, with our history, we can't decide on a policy. We can't make decisions according to threats and according to violence. This is exactly what terrorists want us to do.
So you accept that this may lead to more violence, but that's the price you have to pay.
Exactly. Of course, our security forces...
But what do you gain in the process? The United States still has a wonderful relationship with Israel and will. Wherever our embassy is, won't change that. So why would you want to trade blood for real estate in this case?
First of all, I'm not sure it's blood, and it's definitely not real estate the way we see it. It's a lot more than real estate. You know, first of all, Jerusalem is more than just a piece of land. It has the Israeli government, the Israeli parliament, the Supreme Court, and of course the Western Wall and the holy sites for Jews, but not only for Jews, for Muslims and for Christians. By the way, they are open for the public. People can worship freely. It's not just real estate. It's Israel's heart.
I didn't mean to insult you by that phrase.
No, that's okay. But what I'm trying to say that is a lot more than real estate and a lot more than just a city. And Jerusalem will be the Israeli capital at any future agreement, negotiations, etc. By making that decision, I think we can see an opportunity to restart the peace process, which is stuck, because I think that the Palestinians are waiting for the international community to put pressure on Israel. And they are not coming and sitting and speaking to us directly. And I think now they should understand that can't happen, and we have to start speaking to each other.
Do you think this will accelerate the peace process, or will this set the peace process back?
I think this is an opportunity. I think the Palestinians get the message that they can't just wait for the international community and international organizations like the UN, that in some of its past decisions was trying to, you know, to make Jerusalem a neutral place that does not have a part in Jewish history. So I think that sends a clear message. Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and now we can start negotiating. And by the way, in future negotiations, we can reach to many different kinds of solutions, of agreements. This is not the end of the process. This is maybe it's just the beginning of the process.
You genuinely think this will help the peace process?
Yes, I think that can help to restart the peace process. And again, there are many solutions possible, but to get to a solution, we have to speak to each other. And by speaking to each other, I mean that we have to have the Palestinians sitting with us in the same room, in the same chair, table.
The New York Times has not officially editorialized about this. The Wall Street Journal has. At least if they have, I have not read it yet. But the Wall Street Journal is quite supportive of what the president has said and done. The New York Times has published some op-ed pieces. Thomas Friedman's is among them, and he said this today. Donald Trump could have said two things to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. First, he could have said, "Bibi, you keep asking me to declare Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Okay, I will do that, but I want a deal. Here's what I want from you in return. You will declare an end to all Israeli settlement building in the West Bank outside the existing settlement block that everyone expects to be part of Israel in any two-state solution." And then he talked about another trade-off that could have been made as well. His point is we gave it away, that we should have used the moving of the U.S. Embassy as a bargaining chip to insist that there be a peace process in place before we do this. In general, what do you think your country's reaction to that is?
So I think we have to remember that in Donald Trump's speech, President Trump's speech yesterday, he mentioned the two-state solution, and he mentioned that he's trying to get to a peace agreement between the Israeli and Palestinians. He actually mentioned that more than once.
Right. He said he's not taking sides on the border or boundaries.
Yes, but he did mention that. Yeah, exactly. And he's not taking sides. That means we should get to negotiations. I don't think that in one speech or one decision announcement by the president, he can say, okay, I'll give you this, but I expect Israel to do this, and this will solve all the issues. You know, it's much more complicated than this. I wish it was that simple, that he can declare the Jerusalem as the capital, and the Palestinians will agree to stop all violence, and we will get to a peace, but it's much more complicated than this.
Well,
is
everything
no in the Middle
kidding.
East.
I mean, that is the thing that would just give me pause if I were you. But of course, the American experience is different than the Israelis, and you seem to be maybe more comfortable is not the right word, but acclimated to the sorts of violence that you may have to live with as a result. But the world is reacting. The United States is generally reacting that our president has made a huge mistake here. You may disagree with what I'm saying, by the way, but I'm just reading the papers like everybody else and watching 85 other countries on Earth that are saying that this is precipitous, that this is a bad move right now.
So, again, I don't think that the fact that we already see violence and we might see more violence, that this should stop the president from doing that, that this should stop Israel from doing that. By the way, when Israel was founded in 1948 and in Israel's history, we had many different decisions we took without many countries supporting us or agreeing to be part of that. We have to do that. And you know, we call to all countries to support this decision. We already saw the Czech Republic support this, and we hope to see some other countries recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
Oh, is it your expectation that this might lead to other countries following suit?
We hope so. We hope so. Yeah. We know we won't get all countries on Earth to agree. This maybe happen when the Messiah will come. But for this point, yeah, we would be happy to see more countries agreeing.
Well, I appreciate you coming by. I wish all of us peace. And, you know, whatever you think of the president, let's hope that this works. I mean, if this is a restart and the other side will agree and it leads to peace and a resolution to these issues, who would be against it? So good luck to us all on that. Thank you for coming into our studio.
Thank you. Good to be here, John.
Yeah, welcome again to Chicago. Moran Berman is the Consul for Public Diplomacy at the Consulate General of Israel to the Midwest here in Chicago. Nick Henneman is with Social Works. He's the Deputy Director over there, and he joins us on WGN. Hey, Nick, it's John Williams. How are you?
Hey, John. Pleasure to be on and bring you a bright side of ours a little early here.
Yeah, that's something we do on Fridays, so thank you for noticing that. What is Social Works?
Yeah, so Social Works is a Chicago nonprofit founded by Chance the Rapper. But really, at a local level now, we're really trying to impact our Chicago public schools through our Support CPS initiative. And we really span ourselves across a lot of really boots-on-the-ground work for Chicago here.
How long have you all been in existence?
We're running on a year and change now, John.
So here comes Chance, just like a fast-rising media star, and he very quickly gets socially active. And then is he the founder and funder then of Social Works as well?
He is the founder, and of course, if you recall, he did donate $1 million to the Support CPS initiative in conjunction with the Chicago Bulls. But outside of being the founder and being the one who really creates the most positive outreach for us in the forms of he is heavily involved, our founders are a lot of supporters, like recently with Google and Jewel Osco.
So he is helping you attract businesses like that to donate money, and is the purpose always to turn it into public education, or are there other sort of directions that you all want to go?
yeah, there are certainly other directions. And up until now, we have our new Chance Schools through the new Chance Arts and Literature Fund, which is where those companies contributing have, you know, helped place those funds. But we have other initiatives as well with our Parade to the Poles, as well as our Kids of the Kingdom initiatives.
What's the Parade to the Poles?
Parade to the Polls started last year when Chance took thousands of Chicagoans to the polls to vote, yeah. Help people register. And now ourselves at Social Works, we are deputy registrars, where even each one of us, including myself, our executive director, Justin Cunningham, and others could register anyone to vote. But with that, we're going to be branching into other cities and really activating, you know, a young demographic to not only have opinions, but to get out there as well.
So how does this work? So Google and Chance see an opportunity that's mutually beneficial, or principally beneficial for the kids in the schools. Does he call them? Do they call you? How does that partnership even happen?
It's really a two-way street where whether it's, you know, being reached out to Social Works or the other way around, we make sure we find common grounds in the sense that we're not a one-and-done nonprofit. We really look for that consistency and longevity with any kind of programming or initiatives we implement. And with Google, the goal at the end of the day is long-lasting computer programming for our Chicago public schools, and that being accessible through classes and technology.
Does he have the attitude, I don't know if you can answer this, but you know, if you guys don't do the job, damn it, I'll just do it myself. I'll embarrass you into being more, you know, responsive to the needs of these kids. Is there a little of that going on here?
Absolutely. You know, through our interactions and implementations of new arts, music, and technological programming in our schools, we really get to have a good back and forth with the students themselves. We notice a 20% attendance hike in the schools we've been involved with, as well as one of our schools that is a cohort just reached level one status, which is the highest you can obtain as a public school here in Chicago.
Yeah, but I don't think that answered my question. I mean, are you guys angry or disappointed with the sort of resources that are being given to the schools? It just seems to me like, remember when Chance called out the governor on this, and they had that sort of back and forth a few months ago, that he's going to, by his own example, show government in Illinois what needs to be done. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to call it frustration or just a strive for better, we know and recognize that not only are we hoping for more out of our public funding, but that something equitable and sustainable is offered. So, yeah, we certainly see that the misappropriation of funds is a concern of ours, but it's more so when we re-implement that, how does it look to change the status quo of, you know, everlasting interest from our students and engaging the curriculum we bring into the school.
So why is he so interested in this? He could have had other causes, or he could have had make a lot of money for Chance as a cause nobody would fault him for. Why is he so into this?
Because at the end of the day, really, we want to make sure that every Chicagoan, including our youth, have a chance to be themselves. We want to let them explore their interests and creativity. And they don't have a positive outlook or as well as an environment where that seems obtainable. So really that, you know, that overall perception of feeling a goal and having it being something you can achieve is unfortunately not as present as it should be in our South and West Side communities, being that the environment that they're used to being engaged in can be, you know, a little deterring.
So tell me about this event that's coming up.
Yeah, thank you. So right now with our warmest winter, as everybody knows, tomorrow we'll be going to WGN Television Studios to do our WGN Toy Drive. There we will be receiving toys, you know, with the great partnership of WGN, but also we'll be engaging our community partners. So first off, One Hope United, which is a great local social services agency, will be receiving 5,000 toys tomorrow. And then we have our event coming up, which is a night at the museum in conjunction with the Field Museum. With that, the most exciting thing is that on Wednesday, December 20th, we'll be taking over the Field Museum in true Social Works fashion. We're going to be hosting a ticketed event to showcase the spirit of giving, unity, and thoughtfulness that this time of year should exhibit. Now, having said that, where that really links back is it's kind of, you know, a surprise as of now, but every youth will be leaving with something that night. But the catch is, it is not for them to keep. The point is that they will leave with the thoughtfulness of somebody else in their life that they can make have a better day with what they receive that night. We're going to have a lot of great partners, including the Chicago Bulls. Tiesta Tea will be there, where with Tiesta Tea, we will be going out and doing their Spread the Warmth event on January 19th. So at our night at the museum, it's going to be a donation hub. We're accepting warmth kits, donations of gloves, hats, jackets, scarves, and canned goods. And that will not just be an event of boots on the ground engaging our homeless community. We're going to provide a sense of companionship that night. So we go out to shelters, overpasses, underpasses throughout the city in the coldest month and spend some time with our mobile community, providing a little bit of comfort in relationships that night. So a night at the museum is going to be again on December 20th. We have so many special activations that we're going to keep a surprise that'll make the museum something like you've never experienced it before.
Is Chance going to show up and sing?
You know what? That's going to be for the ticket holders to find out for the event. But all the same,
it'd be
really
pretty cool
will.
If he showed up and sang some songs. That'd be pretty awesome. Popped in.
Well, hey, John, if we see you there that night, we can rejoice in that. But I'll tell you right now that there is no guarantee of a Chance appearance. But what there is a guarantee of is families getting to do something together.
Well put.
That not only involves them feeling that the holidays, you know, can be something other than the commercialism of shopping, but also really bringing in a new outlook of, hey, everybody, we're coming out during these holidays, and we're going to say to ourselves when we leave here tonight, the night of the museum, that we want to have an outlook to help others coming up on Christmas here.
All right, Nick,
so we're going to have a lot of ways of doing that.
All right, I got to go, but what's the web address I go to if I want to buy tickets or sign up or help out somehow?
Yeah, you can visit any of our social medias at Social Works Shy. We also have an Eventbrite page, socialworkschi.eventbrite.com. And people can buy tickets there for $15. We're going to be offering Chicago Public Schools staff, teachers, parents, faculty, and students a discounted rate for that event as well.
What a great night. Okay, that's December 20th. Social Works Shy is what you should search for, and you'll be able to find it. Good luck to you guys, Nick, and we'll see you out there. That sounds like a great evening.
Hey, thanks, John. Big fans here. Have a great day now.
Senator Franken said he'll step out. He hasn't yet, but he said this about the accusations against him by various women.
To doing things that, in fact, I haven't done. Some of the allegations against me are simply not true. Others I remember very differently.
Some people have been critical that he didn't just own it. If you're going to step aside, apologize and say you did it. But he says he can't do that because some of them aren't true. And some of these things he remembers differently. And then, maybe most famously, he said this.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
When you watch him
but
say
this
that,
decision is not about me.
When you watch him say that, you could tell that it was difficult for him to say those words. You know, I voted for Al Franken. I did a radio show in Minnesota for a while, and my colleague up there was a woman named Jordana Green, who you can hear in the afternoons on a radio station called WCCO, AM 830 on your radio dial in Minneapolis. She's on the phone right now. Hey, Jordana, how are you?
Hello, my friend.
How you doing?
Well, it's a busy day here in Minnesota. It's busy. The phone lines are lighting up. I mean, I guess my show's kind of easy today. We just have to open up the phone lines and let everybody talk. And they are fired up, John, really, really divided and almost along party lines.
Really? So Democrats are saying he should stay and Republicans are saying he should go?
Yes. His Facebook page was blowing up with supporters saying, don't leave, don't do this, stay, we need you. And of course, those are people who follow his Facebook page, so they're supporters. But then, I mean, you have on the other side, certainly the Republicans who are now looking at this chance to possibly grab a Senate seat, which of course won't happen because Governor Dayton will appoint somebody, most likely the lieutenant governor, but we don't have confirmation on that.
Yeah, your governor's a Democrat. He'll appoint a Democrat.
Correct.
And the lieutenant governor's she's terrific. I think she would make a good choice. But then then that would just be until 2018, and then somebody would you'd have another special election, right?
We'd have a special election, and there is, of course, speculation that the governor wants somebody who's going to be in it for the long haul, who's going to suffer through the election, and who's going to want to stay in it and fight the good fight to keep that seat. Because if not, you know, you could flip, you could flip parties here in Minnesota. So it's really important that he keep it for him with the Democrats.
Right. So if Democrats want to keep that, it's important that they get a strong person in there now, and then. I don't know, would that person then run again in 2018?
Well, look, that's what happened with Luther Strange in Alabama. They appointed someone that they hoped would be able to hold it and win re-election, and he lost on there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Please don't tell me now Minnesota is being compared to Alabama elections. I might actually have to take offense to that these days.
Okay, here's one. Has anyone mentioned the possibility, and this is bizarre, but has anyone mentioned the possibility that Al Franken might run in the special election in 2018, in that he may have very publicly taken his punishment, declared himself a changed man, and then stood for sort of rehabilitation in politics?
You're kind of blowing my mind right now, because that is a theory that I haven't heard yet, but no. I might have to open that up to the public and see what they think.
Well, especially if his resignation is really just seen as a dart against Roy Moore and Donald Trump. I mean, Are you all interpreting it that way a little bit? Roy Moore is staying in the race, and I still think is going to win. So why is Al Franken deciding that he has to step down?
You know, John, I did think, okay, maybe he's taking the moral high road, so then he can stand on his perch and say, well, we Democrats did it. I took the fall for this. You Republicans now have to as well. But as you know, there were probably 30 other lawmakers yesterday, many of whom were women from his own party.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, and this is my speculation, just me, Jordana, saying the heat from within his own party was too much. And then you look at that, no one's going to want to work with you. No, you are then ineffective. And I think that weighed on him heavily.
Sure, be interesting to see what happens to Roy Moore then, if he actually is seated in the United States Senate. But I didn't call you to talk about that. Our Tammy Duckworth, a female senator from Illinois, has said that he should step out. Your Amy Klobuchar is also a female Democrat member of the Senate. Al Franken's partner there. What has she said?
Well, she was very Minnesotan, John, very Amy-like, very down the middle. She did not say that he should step down. She didn't. Her statement yesterday said that she spoke with Senator Franken in his office that morning and that he would be making an announcement. That's all she said.
Fair enough. What do you think he should do, Jordana?
I definitely think he should have stepped down at this point because of his efficacy. He really cannot be a senator that gets things done. I think he became a bit of a pariah. Nobody wanted to work with him. Nobody wanted his name on their bills and his support. And it was the right thing to do for the people of Minnesota.
When this first went down, you remember my saying that I think he should not, that we're blowing this up. And then you said, John, don't be that guy. Don't be that guy,
don't
John. You're not that guy.
I do remember yelling at you last time I was on, yes.
Yeah, you were yelling at me. But since then, another nine women, some whose names we know, some we don't, have come forward and said that he also acted inappropriately toward them. So I think it's a different thing now for me.
Well, in the beginning, we had the first account, and there were unusual circumstances. They were both actors. It was before he was in office. I have to be honest, even I was a little torn. But then once the pattern started appearing, once there's a pattern, then you can see a pattern of making bad judgments. Then I think that the people of Minnesota, for them and for me, it was, wait a minute, if you really are making bad judgments over and over again, okay, you shouldn't be making judgment calls from me. It's time to go.
Guess so. He's a good senator, though. I mean, if I don't know what being a good senator means, but I think in part it has to mean this. Do you study? Do you travel? Do you talk to people? Do you seek out the opinions and judgments of your constituents, and then do you try and execute them? And Al Franken does that. And some of that's boring and hard and exhausting. Mm-hmm. And he is a good representative of those people who voted for him.
And he was an advocate for women, too. He really was. He was a good senator. And it's a shame that he had to go. But, John, he's also he's caught up in this time. He's caught up in this moment where I don't want to use the word that he's a victim. But if you're going to come down on the right side of history when you look back on this time at the decisions you made,
yeah.
This is what he had to do. He had to do this to look back and say that he did the right thing.
You know, you think about it. This came up yesterday on our show. Didn't it, Steve? Did you have an opinion about this? If Bill Clinton were being accused today, would his presidency have survived it? I said if Bill Clinton was a senator, he would not have survived it because I was thinking of Roy Moore and Al Franken. But, think. If all of a sudden Monica Lewinsky's story breaks right now, does Bill Clinton survive that?
Wasn't Monica Lewinsky more, it was agreeable, you know, I mean, correct me, John. I mean,
no, it was consensual. It was consensual,
but she
was, how old? Aleph, how old was Monica Lewinsky?
She was like 22.
I think she, or maybe 21. She was young. She was a complete... Mm-hmm. It was fantastically inappropriate. Forget the fact that he's president. It was an older man preying on a young, young woman. It was
absolutely wrong. Everything was wrong about it. Mm-hmm.
Hold on a second. I think I got the answer. Aleph, how old is Monica Lewinsky when she had her affair with Bill Clinton?
22.
All right. 22.
Oh, Aleph, she takes your abuse. God bless that woman.
Thank you.
All right. So your phone's in. People are probably embarrassed because you also have in Minnesota Garrison Keillor, who was another just sort of like you thought. I don't know what Garrison Keillor was like. I can't pretend to know him. He was goofy, but
I never met him.
Liberal and I don't know what Al Franken or.
Am I talking to two Minnesotans and I'm the only one who ever met Garrison Keillor?
I think you are.
Wow.
Okay, what was Garrison Keillor like?
He was very unusual.
Yeah, yeah, weird. You know, brilliant. I mean, I guess that's all. The only thing I would say is that he was a brilliant communicator and writer. He was a really funny thinker. He's a brilliant man. That doesn't insulate him from inappropriate behavior, though. But his apology was not as good as it should have been. Garrison Keillor's was.
Oh, no. Horrible.
What are you hearing about Al Franken's apology?
Well, you know, today was unusual because after the Leanne Tweeden thing came out, the second attempt at apology, was really a good one.
Yeah.
This one, now he's denying some of these claims. Most recently, where an aide said he forced his tongue in her mouth after his radio show, he says that is categorically not true, completely denies that. So, I mean, as a human being, I can see where he's like, okay, I'm not laying down for this anymore. That never happened, and I have to say it never happened.
I don't blame him for that.
Like,
right. I mean,
right,
you know,
you
may have to go, but that doesn't mean you have to put up with it. If they're lying, you can. No one's going to believe you, but at least you'll feel good calling them out for their lies.
Well, isn't he filing suit now or something?
Oh, I'm gonna find out about that one. That must have just happened.
Yeah,
all right, I'll look into that.
All right. Go do your radio show, Jordana, and if we can ever do anything for you, Lord knows we've got our own problems down here. Just give us a call, okay?
Fun to talk with you. We miss you, John.
If you're in the Minneapolis and Twin Cities area, listen to a WCCO radio in the afternoons. You'll hear a woman named Jordana Green. Thanks, JG.
Oh,
I love this song. Violetta, did I ask you if I'm going to start featuring people's favorite Christmas songs, albums, or artists?
Oh, man, I have so many.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Kevin was saying yesterday, you're like Miss Christmas.
Yes, I don't really care about the particular artist, but it's just more the songs.
That's a bad answer, I think.
I like This Christmas. I like The Little Drummer Boy. I even like the ones without words, just the bells.
Carol of the Bells, you mean?
The one that's in the beginning of Santa Claus.
I think this one's my favorite.
It's hard not to dance along.
It is so easy to favor the older ones. So when somebody can break through, like, not that that song was recorded yesterday, but that's Paul McCartney anyway. Mariah Carey or Paul McCartney, somebody comes, Harry Connick. I'm thinking of some more contemporary artists whose songs we really love now that aren't Johnny Mathis. Because my Christmas album would probably be a Johnny Mathis Christmas album or a Chipmunk's Christmas album. I like the James Taylor one. I really like Sufjan Stevens. Have you guys listened to the Sufjan Stevens Christmas album? Do you know what I'm talking about? Kevin, are you shaking your head in there?
I know Sufjan Stevens. I don't know his Christmas album, though.
Go figure. He's got an awesome Christmas album.
All right, I'll tune in.
What's your song, artist title, album, Christmas songs
for me?
200? Go.
I've been listening to a ton of Nat King Cole lately.
Yeah.
So okay. The Christmas song.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
I don't get why you have to know the artist. I like the songs.
It's hard to know the artist and the songs because people, I know what you mean. You just kind of turn it on and it's
oh, really?
Music.
I think it's very specific to the artist.
Like, I think that's back when people had albums.
Excuse me? What is the rationale behind that thought?
Well, because you had to go in alphabetical order and find the person you liked at the record store.
Well, there was no streaming back in the day. But, I mean, if you said what's...
Now you put in Christmas music and boom, song after song after song
I
after
know.
Song.
Well, this is interesting because to me, though, it's not just the song. Like, it's remarkable to me that you would say the Christmas song or White Christmas is my favorite Christmas song. I don't think about it that way at all. I think... Johnny Mathis singing White Christmas or
right,
Nat King Cole singing.
Too. Okay,
I need
that.
I need
the
artist too. I'm sorry, this is my show for two more minutes, and if you do the song, I need the person that sang it as well.
Brenda Lee,
Rocking Around the Christmas Tree.
There we go.
There you go.
That's a jam.
Acceptable answer.
Great song.
Okay.
Don't patronize me, Kevin.
It is.
Hey, by the way, how many games have the Bulls won this year?
Three.
Is it three? So who's going to win more games this year, the Bulls or the Bears?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'll go Bulls because they have more opportunities. But I will tell you this, John.
82 games versus 16.
the Cubs have more wins since the start of October than the Bears and the Bulls do. That's a true story.
Oh,
Cubs won four games post-October.
And it was bad.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't horrible. But the Cubs?
Disappointing,
I mean, yeah. It was disappointing, yeah. But
still,
they have four wins. The Bears have three and the Bulls have three. And the Bulls just blew a 17-point lead last night. It's just bad.
Well, you know what breaks your heart, too, about the Bulls is that they show quarters of, you know. I mean, remember, Zach LaVine isn't wearing a uniform for the Bulls yet. And he's really who you got for Jimmy Butler. Lauri Markkanen's coming along. Mirotić hasn't been playing because he got his nose broke by his teammates.
Right.
So the team we have out there, we don't even know who those guys are.
No,
that's not our team. That's these other guys.
Very early, very, very, very early stages of a rebuild.
Rokan, Anna DeVlantis in the studio.
Yes.
Hi, John.
Indeed we are.
What's going on?
Okay, well.
Where to begin?
You don't have that much today, Ro. The president didn't fall apart. There was nothing crazy or insane that happened. Al Franken stepped down.
Your former senator stepped down.
Yeah, today is a day that will live in infamy, isn't it?
Yes.
What a bizarre shame that is.
Yeah, he. It was very weird. I mean,
Exactly.
I watched this and I thought to myself, I never got over the fact that Al Franken was a senator.
I know. How
and
about it?
So now you don't have to grapple with that anymore.
Anyone who knew him before and followed his work before.
There's so many reasons to be unhappy with, not unhappy, but, you know, like, just think, oh, what a weird world we live in that, you know, this guy who, you know, the Al Franken remote broadcast, you know, equipment or whatever that thing was called, we wore the satellite thing on his head. I mean, stop and think, okay, now he's a United States senator. I guess anybody could be in this business. But then it got worse, right? It got weirder. It got stranger. So now what I watched today, I just want to go back and just, I guess, recap what it was that we saw. We saw former comedian, Saturday Night Live writer and cast member Al Franken retire from his career, and not a short career, in the United States Senate, and then take a shot at President Donald Trump,
right,
who I remember from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Sure.
For the grabbing the pee tape.
Right.
And it was all right there, and it was in the well of the Senate. And I thought, this has really come a long way since, I would say, on this date, it's reasonable to mention, FDR standing, very close to that space and giving that, you know, this is a day that will live in infamy speech.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting juxtaposition now that you put it that way.
Yes.
What a shame.
Yeah.
How far we've come.
Well, it's, I don't know.
How far we've gone backwards.
Right.
I
mean, you know, that was a very scary moment in 1941, in December of 1941, for America, and wasn't quite sure. And America came through, changed the world for the better.
But, you know, our expectations for politicians, members of Congress, even the United States Senate, which is, you know, better than maybe the rabble of the House, it's pretty low. You know?
But I would argue that maybe some of this existed before. It just wasn't out there. And we learned that with the Conyers situation and so many others that it happened, but it wasn't outed in the way that it is today.
I got to get out of your
weird.
Way.
All right. Okay.
Have a good show, Ro.
You don't want to stay?
No.
Really?
No, well, I'll listen like millions of Americans.
All right, fine. There, you could stay.